What does a hawk want?
But what a hawk wants is it wants a hunting partner. You are the junior hunting partner. And that hawk will not return to you the affection you feel for it in a way that we humans generally recognize. It won't comfort you when you're sad. A hawk will not come to your defense if you're in trouble. A hawk doesn't want to snuggle or cuddle with you. But just the glory of being in the hawk's presence, just the joy of seeing this magnificent creature in its utter and complete wildness, that's enough.
That's Cy Montgomery. Later in the show, we talk with her about her new book, The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. But first, we talk with James Bridle about his book, Ways of Being, Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for Planetary Intelligence.
More types of intelligence than the human are possible. And that realization seems to be occurring quite widely, just at the moment as we start to really recognize the quite extraordinary abilities of non-humans across the spectrum. And so it seemed to me there was a really fascinating convergence between this cultural fascination with what we call artificial intelligence and the slow realization of something much broader and more than human intelligence that's actually been around us and preceded us all along.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What does it mean to be intelligent? Is it something unique to humans or shared with other beings, beings of flesh, wood, stone, and silicon? Artist, technologist, and philosopher James Bridle seeks the answer in his book, Ways of Being. He explores the different kinds of intelligences that we've lived among since time immemorial, as well as the new intelligences we are creating through technology. What can we learn from them, and how can we change ourselves, our technologies, our societies, and our politics to live better and more equitably with one another and the non-human world? James Bridle draws on biology and physics, computation, literature, art, and philosophy to explore these questions. James Bridle, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is such a wonderful and important book. It's a book about what you call the more than human, not non-human, but more than human. What do you mean by that?
So this term more than human, it comes from the work of the kind of ecologist and philosopher David Abrams, particularly a wonderful book of his called The Spell of the Sensuous. And what Abrams meant in coining that phrase is to remind us constantly that we are one part of a much greater world. So while humans have our own particular abilities, our own certain uniqueness, both as individuals and as a collective, we're part of something much, much greater than us, to which we're always connected. So it's also not quite the same as this term you hear often, which is like the non-human, like humans and everything else. The more than human reminds us that we are unique and special in our own ways, but we are intrinsically connected to everything else. And it's a kind of process of both, you know, recognizing all those qualities that everything possesses and reminding us that we're not at the center of anything either, that we belong to this kind of omnicentric world, which is composed of many different kinds of uniqueness and abilities.
And the title of the book, Ways of Being, has a subtitle, Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for a Planetary Intelligence. So you include machine intelligence in this more than human world. Why?
You have to start somewhere, I guess. And my background is as a computer scientist, as a programmer, as someone who's worked a lot with technology, who is, you know, I was trying to consciously work my way into a more ecological way of thinking. That's what my practice for the last few years has been concerned with. And it struck me very deeply because I've worked with what we call artificial intelligence in various forms over the years, that while it's not always what it's claimed to be, most of what you hear about using the term artificial intelligence is really nothing of the kind. I was fascinated by this hold it has on our imaginations. It seems to have this incredible cultural weight. We really want to believe in the possibility of an artificial intelligence, which after all at heart is a non-human intelligence. And it's really fascinating that the more we build these things that are starting to resemble machine intelligence, we're starting to realize that it's not the same as human intelligence. And so if it's not the same as human intelligence, then more things than human intelligence, more types of intelligence than the human are possible. And that realization seems to be occurring quite widely just at the moment as we start to really recognize the quite extraordinary abilities of non-humans across the spectrum. And so it seemed to me there was a really fascinating convergence between this cultural fascination with what we call artificial intelligence and the slow realization of something much broader and more than human intelligence that's actually been around us and preceded us all along.
Before we dive more deeply into that, because that really is the heart and meat of the book, let's talk a little bit about where we are right now with AI and our current way of approaching the world and how artificial intelligence reflects that. Because you say that the real AI is here already, and it's the corporations. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, what I mean by the real AI is a bit complicated, but I mean, if we're talking about something that has been made by humans, that exhibits agency and intelligence in its own right, that does all the things that we expect AI to do, then corporations are quite a good example. They have what technologists would call sensors and effectors. That is, they can kind of read the world, understand it in certain ways, taking in data, you know, information about profits and losses and market situations. And they have effectors. They can affect the world, usually using people, but you know, they have a set of internal goals that they're trying to achieve, and they manipulate the world and their relationship with the world in order to achieve it. They experience pain in the form of losses of money, right? And they experience what could be termed pleasure in that as an organism, they turn towards it in the form of profit. And also crucially, and I think really important to understand the context of the book, is they have personhood. Right? Under the law, corporations are people. Their speech is protected under law. So they have a standing alongside humans as beings that act in the world. So what we talk about when we talk about AI is not the same as we talk about the corporation. But if you break down, you know, the idea of AI into something that actually acts in the world in these ways and that has this kind of standing as a person, then we already have it in the form of corporations. And that tells you something quite interesting about our ability to think of non-human persons, of non-human beings, and also of the way that we've structured the world, that we have accorded personhood and all of these qualities to profit-seeking corporations, but we haven't yet extended that to non-humans or indeed to all humans.
Yes, I mean, I can hear a lot of people listening to this might say, well, corporations are run by boards of directors who are humans. They're not run by machines. But you're really talking about a different point, and that is the perspective from which, or the worldview, or as you call it, the Umwelt, that motivates corporations and motivates the way corporations are developing AI, something that you've seen where you live in Greece, where there has been the use of AI by corporations to exploit the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd stress this certainly isn't just happening in Greece, but this is where I encountered it most kind of directly because I live in Greece. And I was working and talking to friends who live in a region of northern Greece called Epirus, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world, kind of forests and mountains, and which is under threat from oil and gas exploration and extraction. The Greek government has sold the right to explore and exploit this ground to international oil companies. And while I was researching this, I realized that all of these oil and gas companies are very outspoken about the fact that they're using what they call AI. And this is powerful software that's been made by Microsoft, by Google, by Amazon, by all of the big companies you've heard of. They're using this incredibly powerful software to find and figure out how to exploit most profitably and most efficiently oil and gas reserves that were previously inaccessible. So it's one of the great kind of and terrible paradoxes of our time that as oil and gas become more scarce, and indeed as they become more obviously damaging, they also become more valuable. So it's worth it for these oil companies to tear up even more land in order to get at the oil and gas underneath them. And they're using AI to do this. They're using the best and most advanced technologies we have at our disposal. And I was struck on learning that so deeply, that this thing that we call artificial intelligence is doing something that at a planetary scale is obviously so stupid. That the absolute worst thing we could be doing in the present is tearing up old growth forests, is running pipelines through mountains and burning oil, producing more carbon dioxide. It's against everything we need to do. And so there's something fundamentally wrong with the ways in which we're building technology to facilitate this, the aims and goals of that technology and the people who produce it, but also our very idea of intelligence, if this is what those technologies consider to be intelligent.
And so this book, Ways of Being, really calls for a different imagining of intelligence. Before we dive into that, tell us first what you see intelligence as being.
Oh, well, this is the big question, isn't it? Because obviously, on sitting down to write this, I thought one of my main tasks would be to come up with a really clear and powerful definition of that. And I thought I would find that, you know, in the scientific literature, in the history of psychology and philosophy. But actually, there's no really good definition of intelligence. There's a bunch of different qualities, certain ways of thinking, things like self-recognition, the acknowledgement of oneself as a being, as an individual, certain kinds of planning, being able to think ahead. All of these are certain qualities of intelligence, and they can be kind of mapped individually. But really, when we talk about intelligence, and as we've always talked about intelligence, what we've meant is human intelligence. We've meant what humans do. And you can really see this if you look at the kind of last 100 years of scientific experiments that have sought to find intelligence in other beings, because the yardstick we've always used is this like human intelligence. All the things that we kind of test other beings on, all the tasks we give them in the laboratory to show their intelligence are things that humans do. And that has been piecemeal, to say the best. And it hasn't really encountered anything particularly interesting. What's been really interesting is when we've taken those beings on their own measure, when you start to see intelligence as being how you get on in the world, your ability to survive and thrive as a being with your own body and your own experiences of the world. Because, of course, the kind of intelligence you need to survive either as a prehistoric human or as a modern one is very different from the kind of intelligence you need to survive as an octopus or even as a tree. So intelligence is actually something that is embodied into different beings, depending upon, you know, their circumstances and how we live in the world. But also, crucially, I came to understand in writing this book that another way to think about intelligence is as something that emerges in terms of the relationships that we have with the world. Because, if intelligence comes from experience, then it's not just something that exists inside our heads. It's kind of a product of the relationships that we have with the other things and beings that we encounter in the world. So I started to think of intelligence really, first of all, as not being human, but also as not being something contained in our own heads, but something as almost like an emergent property of the world when we start to pay attention to it and to interact with it. And of course, if you understand all other beings as having that potential for kind of agency and interaction, for understanding the world on their own terms, then that intelligence is something that can exist everywhere.
James Bridle, in Ways of Being, you devote a lot of attention to different forms of intelligence that you say has independently evolved in different ways, and, you know, what you call convergent evolution. Let's take the example of the octopi, which you referred to before, a totally different, one might even say, alien form of intelligence. Talk about the octopus.
Yeah, I mean, the octopuses are such fascinating creatures, because it's hard to think of an organism that we can interact with, right, at human scale. Like you can go swimming and you can meet one of these things, as I've done, and you can actually interact with it. You know, you can play with these things. You can muck about in the sea with them. You can have a relationship. Octopuses recognize individual human faces, so if you go back to it after a week, it'll recognize you as an individual. And yet, at the same time, you can't imagine a being that can do that and yet is so different to us, that lives, you know, in such a radically different environment under the sea, and that has such an extraordinarily different body to it, this kind of squishy, strange creature. Octopuses, their brains are not contained just within their own heads, but the neurons are actually spread out throughout their entire bodies. They have bundles of neurons all the way down their arms. And it even appears that those arms are capable of acting independently of the central brain. So the octopus is less than individual in this kind of confederation of intelligent parts. And yet they have strange similar qualities to us. For example, the octopus eye is incredibly similar to the human eye, right? They're these kind of gel-filled orbs with a lens and rods and cones for sensing color. But our nearest relative to the octopus, it lived probably 600 million years or so ago at the bottom of the ocean, and it was blind. And so the eye, this eye that the octopus has and that the human has, these eyes evolved separately and yet came towards a similar form, although slightly different. The octopus eye is actually kind of better because the optic nerve doesn't come into the back of the eye like it does in humans, which gives us a blind spot. The octopus doesn't have that. So its eye is similar in form, but different in the way that it's built. And that's 600 million years down the evolutionary tree. So like a blind worm lived on the ocean floor, and then 600 million years up again, you know, to the octopus. That's the distance that separates us and the octopus. And yet we have these features in common. And we also have a kind of intelligence in common. As I said, octopuses are can recognize individual faces and do all kinds of other extraordinary things, solving puzzles, famously escaping from aquariums. They've evolved their own intelligence. And so this quality, intelligence, this ability to do clever things in the world, has clearly, in the case of humans and octopuses, evolved not once, but twice, like the eye has. And if twice, then obviously and clearly so many more times.
Another example of intelligence that has evolved independently is plants. Intelligence, in other words, doesn't depend on a brain. Talk about memory and learning in plants.
So this is a really extraordinary result that's still baffling a lot of people. And one of the reasons it's so baffling to us is we don't think of plants as having capabilities in the same way as we think of animals as having them. And yet they clearly do. So a few years ago, there was an extraordinary series of experiments done by an Australian scientist called Monica Galliano. And what she did in her experiments was she took a whole load of mimosa plants. If you don't know the mimosa, it's a kind of small, looks almost like a little kind of fern, a little green plant. But the mimosa is quite famous in scientific experiments because it reacts very quickly. If you touch it, it immediately curls up all its leaves. So it has this really clear stimulus response that's really, you know, easy to see and very useful in experiments. And what Galliano did was she put these plants on a little rail, kind of about 10 inches high, with a little foam pad at the bottom, which meant she could drop the plants just like 10 inches onto this little cushion and kind of give them a shock that would, it wouldn't harm them, but it would cause them to do this thing of closing their leaves up. And she did this with the plant, and it closed its leaves up. And then she'd do it a couple more times, and it would close its leaves up a couple more times, and then it would stop. And she tested them in other ways. She poked them and did other things. This wasn't just exhaustion. This wasn't some other stimulus. It was only dropping the plants in this way that meant they stopped closing up their leaves. They stopped doing it anymore. They'd learned that this particular effect of dropping wasn't damaging to them, and so they stopped doing it. And not only that, she tested cohorts of these plants weeks and months later and discovered that they exhibited the same behavior. They hadn't just learned that this particular effect wasn't dangerous to them. They remembered it weeks or even months later. And this is extraordinary because mostly because we have no idea how they do this, right? We don't know what part of the plant or what mechanism allows it to learn and remember in this way, and yet they definitely do it. And so this is not just a new realization, but it's almost like a new kind of knowledge. And it's very interesting to me that it took Galeano a long time to publish this research, not just because her results were so extraordinary, and these, you know, these have been tested by the scientists and so on and so forth. Not just were the results so extraordinary, but it was almost impossible to know, like, where to put this knowledge, because science has this kind of systems of journals, you know. But a realization that plants have memory, like, does this belong in a biology journal or does it belong in a psychology journal? It's a new realization about the world that doesn't fit our existing model. And that seems to happen over and over again when we lose some of our preconceptions about the other abilities of other beings. They're always based on our own assumptions, of course, because we don't believe the plant can do this because it doesn't have a brain. And yet it does. And so there are other ways of doing these things and other ways of being in the world that are so different to us and yet, you know, produce these extraordinary abilities.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with James Bridle about his new book, Ways of Being: Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for a Planetary Intelligence. And yet, this is the way we think. This is our blindness. Yet we know that probably for the vast stretch of human history, human beings did understand that plants have consciousness. I remember once that I went to the Blackfoot Reservation in Montana and I met a medicine man there who told me that a plant had told him that it could cure cancer, and he used it exactly in that way. You had an experience which you allude to in the book in Ways of Being, in which you took the ayahuasca plant. You don't really say what your experience was, but did a plant talk to you?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that yes, this book is written from my perspective and from one particular cultural perspective, which is broadly the cultural perspective of post-Enlightenment Western European culture. And much of what I say in this book is incredibly obvious to someone who grows up in an indigenous community or traditional knowledges, non-Western perspectives, particularly forms of animism and other cosmologies that have always admitted the intelligence and beinghood of other creatures. And so what I have to say is absolutely nothing new to them, and is in fact utterly self-evident. And so for, you know, essentially, I'm writing for myself, for my own realizations, and for those and for others who have yet to make perhaps this kind of rediscovery and reimagining of the world. But yes, my own awareness very much stemmed from direct encounters like this. And that if you, one of the effects of taking ayahuasca, this vine, is that you may perhaps meet and speak directly to other beings, such as plant spirits, which previously were inaccessible to you because of your own mental framework of the world. I had never spoken to a plant so directly before because I simply didn't have the imagination to do so that this particular substance kind of brought up in me. It's still an experience that I struggle to speak and write about because it doesn't fit within the language and knowledges I have as an individual for speaking about such experiences. But Monica Galeano, who I just spoke about, is a really interesting example of this, because she's written extensively about the fact that as well as performing the experiments she did, these rigorous scientific experiments, she too has a shamanic practice in which she has worked with certain plants to have these spiritual experiences in which those plants spoke to her directly and even helped her design the experiments which allowed their abilities to become manifest within the framework of the scientific method. And what I really love about Galeano's work is that she's incredibly forthright about these experiences. But if you don't believe that stuff, if that doesn't make sense to you within your own framework, it doesn't matter, because she also did the work to make it real within the scientific perspective by performing, you know, scientific experiments within the framework of the scientific method that are peer-reviewed and reproducible and all of these things. So both explanations, both accounts can carry equal weight. You can believe one and not the other, and it doesn't matter, it still stands. And for me, the greatest value is to be found in the kind of syncretism between those things, understanding that there are multiple ways of understanding and approaching these worlds that differ for individuals, that are powerful in different ways, but all ultimately point towards very, very similar conclusions.
Yes, you say investigating intelligence of non-human creatures or more than human, we need to stop asking if other beings are like us and ask what it's like to be them.
Yeah, absolutely. It requires this kind of extraordinary willingness to imagine things that are so deeply unlike ourselves that we're not very good at doing as a species. We tend to, you know, species, and particularly as a Western European culture, we're not very good at imagining ourselves into radically different situations and ways of knowing. Yet we are entirely capable of it. It's something that almost all of us have done to some degree. You know, even the most perhaps conservative outlook might admit the possibility of the intelligence of a pet, of a dog or something like this, or of having a deeply spiritual relationship with a garden or a plant, because of a very innate, what the biologist E.O. Wilson calls biophilia, a deep kind of human yearning for this relationship with the natural world. And that for me is the basis of a real openness to seeing the other beings that surround us, not merely as kind of inanimate objects or kind of lesser beings, but creatures with their own awareness, beinghood, and vitality that are absolutely the equal of our own, however much they may differ. And it's really important to bear that in mind, even when those creatures are ones that we could not possibly imagine ourselves into. It's like it's almost impossible for us to imagine, you know, what it is like to be an ant, or indeed to be a tree. And yet, simply by virtue of being in the world ourselves, of living under this sky, on this earth, we know what it is like to be. And the act of imagination, then, is extending that to everybody else.
I'd like to go back to artificial intelligence. Recently, Google suspended an engineer, Blake Lemoine, who says that AI has achieved sentience. You talk in the book about the difference between the automatic computers that we have, the binary computers, and those that are open-ended, that you call it undecidability. I wonder if you could tell us about that, and then I'm going to ask you a question about whether AI has already achieved sentient, as has been claimed by Google engineer Blake Lemoine.
Yeah, so there's this really fascinating kind of footnote in Alan Turing's first papers on computing. So Alan Turing was the computer scientist who kind of laid the foundations in the 1940s and 50s for all the computers that we have today, right? Almost every computer that exists in the world, and certainly all the ones that most of us use, are what we call Turing machines, named for Alan Turing, or what he called automatic machines. That is, they're just boxes with lines of code running in them. And the reason they're called automatic machines is because they just run through that set of programs and do whatever they're told to do. Even if there's mistakes in there, it'll execute that mistake. It's just an absolute simple step-by-step process. And that's what almost all computers in the world do now, including all the ones that we call machine learning or artificial intelligence. They're just following a set of programs. But in his first papers in the 1940s, Turing alluded to something else that computers could be. He just said that alongside the automatic machine, there was also this thing that he called the Oracle machine. And he says almost nothing about it, except in a footnote, he says that whatever the Oracle machine is, it can't be a machine, which sounds like a paradox, except what he means is it can't be automatic in this way. It can't just be a set of enclosed instructions doing whatever it's told to do. What he meant was that it has to have some kind of communion with the world, because one of the things that makes us human, that makes all living beings, is that we are not self-contained sets of instructions. We're constantly in communication with the world around us. We're made by our experiences and our encounters with others. And so an Oracle machine, in Turing's term, would be a machine that does something similar, that is not simply a result of a set of pre-programmed steps, but one that is in touch with the world around it in all the complex and infinite ways that a living being is. And as such, we don't even know how to make that machine. There's certain ideas of how you could kind of make a basic machine and release it into the world to do some interesting things. And there are examples of things that do that, but they in no way approach the kind of complexity that even the simplest living organism has in its relationship with the world. But undoubtedly, if we are ever going to make anything like a real AI, it will need that kind of experience of the world. And the ways in which it's developed, the experiences that it has, will shape it utterly in the way that all living organisms are shaped.
And isn't that what neural networks are supposed to do? And why this Google engineer thinks that the chatbot that he has been chatting with has achieved sentience?
It absolutely is. But I'm not so, this term that's used often is kind of sentience, which is not a term that I use very much, because when you talk about sentience, you start to talk about consciousness and other quite mysterious things, which are fascinating. But they're not really the same. They imply something deeper and stranger than the kind of intelligent behavior that I'm talking about. I'm pretty sure that nothing that Google has built is sentient in that way, or really ever will be, because it's going to be brought up in such a narrow version of reality. It's going to be raised in such a tight, airless little space that it's not going to have the extraordinary range of abilities or encounters that any other kind of organism has. But that certainly doesn't preclude something potentially very interesting coming along, or something not so interesting, but that nevertheless will impact the world in this powerful way. And and that's maybe perhaps actually that's what's interesting, getting to the point of this Google claim is that it reveals once again our incredible desire to see this kind of sentience in the world. And if intelligence really is, as I come to believe, more of an interaction, right, a relationship rather than an ability, then this program possesses it in spades. I don't know whether it's internally consciousness, but it's already acting in the world in a way that makes intelligence meaningful.
And so finally, all of this, your book, really leads to, I think, the most important lesson, which is the need for us to have solidarity. What do you mean by that?
It's really important, for me personally to think about not just these kind of amazing realizations that we're having about the world that surrounds us, its kind of intelligence and vitality and beinghood, but also what that means for us and how it should change our relationships with the world. Because it's increasingly obvious that humans alone are incapable of structuring the world in a way that's beneficial to most of us, let alone to the planet as a whole. Such a kind of way of living in the world is only possible when we take into account the needs and desires and the knowledge and intelligence of all the other beings that we share the planet with. And so that really insists that we have to have some kind of political framework for relating towards other beings. And by politics, I just mean the everyday decision-making of how we live in the world, right? I don't necessarily mean like high-level parliaments and this kind of stuff, but I just mean how we make decisions about how we all live together. That's the essence of politics in the end. And the form of politics that I see as being, most applicable to that is what we call solidarity. Because solidarity is the form of politics that says that everyone has equal standing. Even if we don't fully understand the other that we share the planet with, and which is often the case when we talk about relationships with other beings, we can still say that we have political solidarity with one another when we say that their right to be, their right to life, their right to thrive on this planet is as important as ours. It's a form of a radical equality and an insistence that everybody counts and everybody matters. And everybody in this case is really everything on this world.
I could not agree more. James Bridle, your book is a wonder to read. Ways of Being, Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for Planetary Intelligence. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. I'm lovely talking to you.
James Bridle. Listen to an excerpt from Ways of Being by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, The Hawk's Way. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on your podcast app. It really helps others to find the show. Cy Montgomery is noted for her friendships with animals. There are the octopuses she wrote about in her bestseller, The Soul of an Octopus, the pig, Christopher Hogwood, and the myriad animals she lived with during both childhood and adulthood that she wrote about in How to Be a Good Creature. But her latest relationship can't really be called a friendship. It's more like a vassalship to a noble being, a hawk. She writes about learning to be a hawk's junior hunting partner in her new book, The Hawk's Way, and what that taught her about the heart of wildness. Cy Montgomery, welcome back to Writer's Voice. Cy Montgomery, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
I'm so pleased to be here.
This is just such a beautiful book, and a surprising book in many ways. The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. You know, I had no idea that hawks, as you say, are different from any other animal. That's a pretty big statement. Why?
Well, it certainly was different for me. Most of the animals that I've gotten to know, from giant 750-pound pigs to octopuses to even rhinoceroses or rhinoceri, respond to gentle touch. Once you convince each other that neither of you wants to eat the other, generally, animals who know you like to be touched. This is not the case with a hawk. They really don't like that. Now, everyone's an individual, and there's always a possibility that there is one who does. But these creatures want something out of life totally different from anyone else I'd ever known before. And getting to know them allowed me to touch an utterly new relationship that opened up my mind and heart in a way that was completely new and very humbling.
And say more about that, because one of the things you say is that hawks taught you how to love like a god.
Yeah. You know, all the other animals that I've gotten to know well, they reciprocate your affection. Even octopuses. The octopuses who I've known have not only clearly recognized me, they've enjoyed my touch, they've sought my company, and they have shown their emotions to me. Literally, after being separated from one of my octopus friends for an unusual amount of time, when I think I was in Mongolia or one of my other expeditions, when I came back, we literally flew into each other's arms, this octopus friend, Octavia, and I, and hugged each other. Well, a hawk will fly to you. But what a hawk wants is it wants a hunting partner. You are the junior hunting partner. And that hawk will not return to you the affection you feel for it in a way that we humans generally recognize. It won't comfort you when you're sad. A hawk will not come to your defense if you're in trouble. A hawk doesn't want to snuggle or cuddle with you. But just the glory of being in the hawk's presence, just the joy of seeing this magnificent creature in its utter and complete wildness, that's enough. And the Greeks said that there were four different kinds of love, and they named philia, you know, for the brotherly love, and they named eros for erotic love. And there's a kind of love called storge that parents feel for their offspring and vice versa. But the highest form of love, according to the Greeks, was agape, which was a non-transactional love. It was the love that you feel for God and God feels for you. Well, that's the kind of love that you have with a hawk. You love that hawk the way an Aztec loves the sun. You love them because of what they are, not what they give you back, because simply being in their presence is more than enough repayment.
And it takes a profound amount of respect and paying attention. Tell us, how did you get involved with this? Now, of course, you know, listeners to our previous interviews with you or readers of your books know that you have profound relationships with many different kinds of animals. But what brought you specifically to hawks?
Well, as with many things, it was my husband, the writer Howard Mansfield, who is ever my hero and champion, and who, over the course of the 40 plus years we've known each other, has noticed that I have a thing for any kind of animal. So it was he who had heard on the radio an ad for this thing called the New Hampshire School of Falconry. And he knew I loved animals. He knew that I was very interested in birds. And he said, well, the New Hampshire School of Falconry is just half an hour from our house here in Hancock, New Hampshire. Why don't you give this lady a call? So I called up Nancy Cowan in Deering, New Hampshire. And I did not know it, but I, along with my friend who I brought with me, Celine Chicoin, became Nancy's first students at the New Hampshire School of Falconry. And what I thought, of course, was like, oh, won't it be cool to be up close and personal with these amazing creatures? I mean, we all get to see hawks often just as specks in the sky when they're migrating south for the winter. Sometimes we see them perched on telephone poles as we drive down the highway. But in falconry, you've got one of these majestic birds right on your leather glove, inches from your face. And that's all I really thought about. I didn't think it through and realize that becoming a falconer, or even taking a lesson in falconry, is about hunting. And I'm not a hunter. I'm a vegetarian. I'm somebody who sees a squirrel dead on the road and it ruins the rest of my day. I have friends who are hunters, and I don't disrespect hunters who are eating what they catch, but it's not something I've ever wanted to do. I'm perfectly happy to have a broccoli. But catching and killing prey, particularly chasing the prey, is what a hawk lives to do. And that's why they just don't fly away and leave the falconer. The falconer has to prove to the bird that they are a worthy hunting partner, because otherwise the bird is free to just leave.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Cy Montgomery about her new book, The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. And how did you deal with or confront this affective dilemma, emotional dilemma, between your profound respect and desire for life for all living beings and becoming, as you describe it, a servant of a hawk?
Right. Well, I've got to say, my very first lesson with Nancy did not come out the way I might have envisioned at all. Within the first, 5 minutes of getting this gorgeous bird, Jazz, who was a Harris's hawk, female Harris's hawk, on my glove, I'm walking down the street with Jazz the Harris hawk. My friend Celinda has a smaller, beautiful Lanner falcon on her glove. And Nancy had Banshee, a peregrine, on her glove. Well, within just almost instantly, Banshee bit Nancy in the face and blood's flowing out of my instructor's cheek and dripping onto the ground. I didn't expect anything like this. And people are they're driving by, they apparently are used to seeing Nancy walking around with a bird of prey on her glove. No one notices or is upset that she's bleeding. Neither was Nancy. She just considered this, man, she's just being a brat. This didn't upset her very much, although it must have hurt like anything. Then someone pulls over, rolls down the window, and hands Nancy this dead woodcock, which I thought was food for her hawks, but it was actually for her dinner. It was just such a strange other world. I can't even tell you. And this is my first lesson. But I was so transfixed by the raw power and majesty and wildness of jazz that nothing else mattered. I just had to be with that bird. I wanted to learn as much as I could from these birds and from Nancy. And even though to get them to come to your glove when you're training the young birds, Jazz was a pretty young bird, you're feeding them cut up bits of dead baby chicks. Well, you know, I've raised baby chicks from infancy, from days after hatching. They snuggle in my sweater, they sit in my hair. They come when I call, they leap into my arms. They pet me, they recognize me, and here I've got this dead baby chick in my hand. But somehow, for the privilege of getting to know this bird and her kind, I was able to get past that.
And you developed, I mean, you became an apprentice, actually, to Nancy Cowan.
Well, technically, I wasn't. Technically, she invited me to be her apprentice. But to be an apprentice officially, I would have had to capture a wild red tail, build a muse or an aviary for it, and keep the red tail at our house here in Hancock. And that was where I couldn't do that. I had chickens of my own. And also I travel so much. Who would take care of the hawk while I was away? Well, my poor husband certainly didn't want to. He said this was like tending a loaded gun. So while I learned from her as a disciple, certainly, as you know, I was a student, but although I was tempted, technically I was not an apprentice.
Well, that makes more sense, actually, because I just recently adopted two domestic ducks. And they're the first birds, fowl, that I've ever raised. And I have a resident hawk on my land. I live in the middle of a forest. And after reading your book, I got very worried about my poor little ducks.
Oh.
Although it does seem that there are things that one can do to lessen the possibility of the ducks becoming prey. So I think what is so fascinating in this book, The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty, Cy Montgomery, is the way the hawk enters into an alliance without this kind of affection that other animals, I mean, we think of when we have working partnerships with dogs, there is a lot of affection that goes on between the dogs and the humans. So why does a hawk enter into an alliance with a human without having any kind of affection for them?
Right. And if they do have affection, and they may, it's just not the affection that we recognize, but it's a useful partnership. And if you are not a good hunting partner, your hawk's out of there. So what you need to do is show the hawk that you are worthy of serving her. And the way you do this is if you are capable of scaring up some game. So you're walking through a field, your hawk flies off your glove and is sitting in a tree watching with those amazing devouring eyes that are capable of seeing in detail that we can't even imagine. They see colors that we can't name. They can see detail over distances that seem impossible to us. So as we're walking, we may not even see it, but we may make some little critter, a mole or a vole or a shrew or a rabbit, scurry out And we may not see the motion, but the hawk will. And the hawk will realize that you made yourself useful. And the other way is if you hunt with a dog. Normally, hawks don't like dogs. And Harris's hawks, like Jazz, who live in the Southwest, they actually hate coyotes and will scream at them and sometimes will like try to attack them. They hate them so much. But hunting is so crucial and so important to these birds that if they notice that the dog is pointing out the presence of game, that the dog can smell the game, they will notice it and bam, it goes into that like file folder in their brain of hunting success. And now they don't have to yell at the dog and hate the dog all the time. Now the dog is a hunting partner too.
And you talk about hawks that have been known to actually fly into the cars of their, you know, human partner to get to the hunting site, fly out, then fly back in to get back home.
Yes, that blew me away. That was from Stephen Bodio, who is a masterful writer, and he's written a number of books on hawks, including Eagle Dreams about the fantastic falconers in Mongolia who hunt with eagles and are able to hunt wolves with eagles. That's how big these eagles are and how brave they are. And I read about that and was just completely blown away. But this is one of the oldest and deepest human animal partnerships that our kind has ever had. It's very ancient. It goes back thousands of years. And it shows to me that our kind really is capable of understanding what another species wants and of becoming worthy of this partnership. And that's something that gives me hope about people.
Yeah, I wonder if you could say more about that, actually, because, you know, a hawk is a very particular creature, but I really get the sense in this book that you're drawing a much larger lesson for us humans.
Well, every animal kind of gives you a new way to widen your senses, your awareness, your compassion. You know, we learn so much from the animals in our lives if we open ourselves up to what they have to show us. And one thing that hawks teach us, if we get to know them, is a lesson that humans very badly need, and that is humility. You know, our kind seems to want to be in control all the time. But a falconer can't be in control of their bird. Now, often in our relationship with dogs, it's defined, and I think unwisely, by the idea of control. Can't you control your dog? Well, you know, your dog chooses to love you, but dogs created themselves out of wolves because they wanted to be our friends. They are great at loving us. They are great at making us love them. Hawks do none of this. We are the ones that have to approach them in a humble way, saying, you know, how can I serve you? And that's a great thing for us to learn.
There's a tragic story in the book about a hawk that was killed by another one of its kind. Tell us about that.
Hawks kill other hawks. And this has happened to my falconry instructor, Nancy, with a bird who she loved very much. It was a little peregrine she had raised from a chick named Witch. And she loved this bird, and she was responsible for this bird because she raised her from a baby. And those that we raise as babies, we can't help but feel that, you know, we're somewhat responsible for them. But she took this bird out on a hunt, and above her, she saw a big red tail. And she tried to call Witch down to her glove where she knew she'd be safe. But hawks are very tuned into their instincts. And, you know, the wisdom of the ancestors tells them that the hawk that's above you is the dangerous hawk. So Witch would not fly down to Nancy's glove. Instead, she tried to climb higher, but the other hawk remained above. And then the two hawks flew out of Nancy's view, and Nancy tried desperately to get to where they were. She ended up flagging down a logging truck and finally arrived at where she thought the birds were going. And there was only one bird, and it was the red tail. And it was looking much fatter than it was before. And she went out for days calling for her hawk. And she is certain that that red tail ate Witch.
A tragic story, and yet that's the way of all hawks, is it not?
It totally is. And there's no evil in it. There's no malice in it. There's no cruelty in it. It's just wildness.
And you also write about it so beautifully. It's a short book. It's almost like a prose poem sometimes.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much. And coming from you, you're such a great writer yourself. That really means a lot. Thank you.
Cy Montgomery. Go to writersvoice.net for links to an audio excerpt from The Hawk's Way and to see photos of the magnificent birds Montgomery writes about. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.